You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Deb O'Callaghan with you on this Monday. Melbourne Cup Day tomorrow usually signals the start of harvest. Well, it used to back in the day. How are you going out there? I'd love to see your photos on text or on our Facebook page. You can text to 0467 922 783 or you can post a photo on our Facebook page. Have you kicked off Harvest 17 yet? And it must be in an election soon. The policies are flying hard and fast. This one's pretty drastic from the Libs today to change NRM boards. And the body they'd like to call it is Landscape SA, if elected next year.
But really go back to basics when it comes to managing the environment, back to focusing on the quality of soil, water management and pest control, which was the original mandate of NRM, I believe, when it was first initiated. But
a back-to-basics policy on NRM, says the Liberal Party. And stereotypes. Who do you know that breaks a rural or farming stereotype? I reckon this guy might.
G'day, I'm Sam. I'm from Adelaide and I'm learning to shear this week. So, I'm actually at University Flinders doing medical science at the moment. What I like about getting into shearing as a profession is that the season lines up well with the uni holidays. Following my grandpa's footsteps, he was a gastroenterologist all his life and retired on a farm. So it's a family thing, I guess.
I'd love to hear if you've broken a rural or farming stereotype. To think I just served in a cafe in my uni holidays. No shearing was the case there. That's all coming up on The Country Hour with me, Deb O'Callaghan. But first up today, we're going to be talking fires, and it feels like there's been a bit of a surge or a spate in hay shed fires out there amongst you. I'm not going to tell you how to suck eggs because there's a lot of you out there that know what cause hay fires, but we thought it was a good time to catch up with the CFS and see what's going on. We're joined today by Phil McDonough. He's the compliance officer. Phil, what is going on out there?
Well, this time of year we tend to have a number of haystacks catch fire because farmers are not quite really in the practice of stacking their hay away and making sure that the moisture content's down low enough.
We have got a few people cutting hay this year that wouldn't have normally because of the poor season. Can that contribute to the issue as well?
It can. It all depends on the moisture content when it's baled. So a lot of farmers will actually cut it, then leave it to dry out a little bit before baling. Some may be in a hurry and actually bale them while the moisture content is still high. Some farmers will actually leave those bales in the paddocks long enough that they actually dry out by themselves. But when you stack them while they're still high in moisture content, provides an ideal environment for the bacteria to go crazy within the hay bales.
So we've had, I can think of two, Laura and Lamoureux. Have there been any others recently?
Yeah, there's been a couple of others as well, one around Hart and there was another one earlier in the season as well.
And so it doesn't matter what region it is, it just is if you stack a hay bale and it's not dried out enough, this could happen to you.
Yeah, it could. And it all depends on the weather conditions and the temperature of the days and the like. So although you've actually stacked some stuff away while it's still high in moisture content, when we start getting those higher temperature days, that's when it sort of triggers the bacteria to get going. And once the heat starts building up within those hay bales, that's when we start to get the spontaneous combustion occurring.
But I've been, you know, I'm sitting out there listening, thinking, I've been doing this for years, Phil. I know what I'm doing. Can you still make mistakes?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people can misjudge what this moisture content could be. There is equipment out there that you can use now, but a lot of the old cockies out there will actually just say, oh, look, you know, you stick an iron bar in the middle of it, leave it for a bit, and pull it out. If it's hot, then you pull it apart. So the old tried and tested techniques are still as appropriate now as they ever have been.
So what should people do? Like, what is the best practice from your perspective?
Just to actually monitor the moisture content level. There are some balers out there that do have this equipment, monitoring equipment on them. And if they do, that's great. If they don't, then you just need to be mindful that the higher the moisture content, the more ideal environment you're providing for the bacteria within those bales to increase the heat, which will then ultimately end up in a spontaneous combustion if they don't have a method of getting around that heat build-up.
We're hearing from Phil McDonough, CFS Compliance Officer. Phil, once a fire gets going in your haystack, is there anything you can do or shut the doors and call the CFS?
Well, it depends how early you can get it and whereabouts in the haystack the fire has started. If it's in a large stack, then you may be able to save some of it. But there is also a risk of smoke taint to the remainder of the stack. And once smoke enters the rest of the stack, stock, you can't use it for feed because stock just don't like the taste of smoky hay.
Fair enough. So is this season, you're looking at lots of things this season. We were talking about rock strike potentially with the lower crops last week when we were down at the CFS. Is this season particularly susceptible to haystack fires, or is it just something that happens every year?
It generally does happen every year, and it's not just this time of the season. We do have spates of haystack fires from time to time, and it could be even as late in the season as March or April. It just depends on what's going on at the time and what's happened as part of the baling process. But as far as we're concerned at the moment, it's just the normal thing we're seeing as we're starting to get into the season. For around fires and baling and harvesting activities.
But nonetheless, good to have a reminder. So I had seen a few of them popping up on the CFS websites, and it is a good reminder for those just to keep an eye on your stacks.
Absolutely. Just remain vigilant and check them on a regular basis.
Because the very time you probably go away from the farm for the weekend, that'll be when it happens, won't it?
Absolutely. Murphy always plays a role.
That's right. All right. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
No worries, Deb.
Phil McDonough is the CFX Compliance Officer. A reminder to check your hay fires or haystack fires or heat. Make sure you are keeping an eye on that. It's 12 minutes past 12. Next up, state politics.
A trailblazer of Australian television.
The 29-year-old marching into Clyde Packer's office.
I want to run my own program.
He said, right, can you produce a program?
I fibbed a little bit and said yes.
Welcome to A Current Affair.
Mike was always popular with the ladies. He told me, I'm a sex symbol and you're a sh** kicker.
What a life he's had.
Now, Mike Willacy faces the fight of his life.
It broke me up that he was saying, I'm going to fight.
I don't want to start looking backwards. Always want something coming up.
An Australian Story exclusive tonight on ABC TV and iView.
Not a bad reporter. Mike, good luck to him on his health battles. Now, in 2004, the state government created the Natural Resources Management Boards that would help develop and manage environment programs across the state. This decision divided a lot of the community, and a rise in the NRM levy last year saw many express their frustrations. The South Australian Liberal Party says the system is broken and yesterday announced a policy that will see a shake-up of the Natural Resources Management Scheme. David Spears is the opposition spokesman for environment. We will hear from the current environment minister in a moment. But David Spears, spoke with Courtney Howe from ABC Southeast this morning.
Well, we are proposing fairly radical reform to the NRN system, including the repeal of the NRM Act and the abolition of NRM boards as they stand. And we recognise that you do need something to manage our environment. So we will replace that with a body called Landscape SA, which will have a look across the whole of the landscape in particular regions, but really go back to basics when it comes to managing the environment, back to focusing on the quality of soil, water management and pest control, which was the original mandate of NRM, I believe, when it was first initiated. But unfortunately, over the last decade, that has drifted away and become less and less focused in local communities, more centralised in Adelaide. So people in the region certainly have told me since I became Shadow Minister, they want this system fixed, and we've put on the table a fairly significant body of reform.
You have said that the system is broken. What do you see are the major issues with the scheme as it stands?
What I see, and certainly what fairly detailed engagement with regional communities showed, was that the system was it's highly centralised in Adelaide. So staff are employed through Adelaide. Lots of the levies go to Adelaide, and there is no guarantee in some instances that they come back to be spent in the region. People feel that they don't have local control over what happens. They feel disconnected from the boards and the and what happens on the ground. So we've actually said, as part of our reforms, we will set up, each region will have a board of 7 members, but 3 of those members will be elected directly from the community. So we're guaranteeing a community voice. 3 out of the 7 members will be elected, possibly in the longer term, at the same time as local government elections. And anyone in a region will be able to put their hand up and say, I have an opinion, I've got something to contribute, I'll stand for election to an NRM board.
As you mentioned there, you will be scrapping the NRM boards and replacing them with Landscape SA. So how exactly will they be different to what we have right now?
Well, as I said, they'll comprise of some directly elected members out of particular regions. They will have a very clear responsibility for managing only the activity that occurs within a particular region. No more levies drifting back to Adelaide. Boards will have to account very directly for how their land and water levies are spent in a particular region, and it will only be by agreement with other boards that you would have cross-regional activity. So very much decentralised and very localised decision making. We will also, boards will employ their own general manager, and staff will be employed at the local level.
Now, transparency is one of the things that many people bring up, as you mentioned, about where the money, the levy is being put towards and what programs it's funding. Will they have to give a more detailed description of exactly where everyone's levy is going towards and what programs they're funding?
Yes, under our reforms, we are saying that each board will have to provide a publicly available budget outlining how levies will be spent in both the forthcoming financial year and where levies have been spent in the previous financial year. So transparency will be at the very heart of this. Now, I think that will happen more naturally with decentralised boards anyway, and with that community voice being elected onto the boards. I think that's going to happen in a much more natural way. But we're also going to require those budgets to be published online. At the moment, even as the Shadow Minister, it's very difficult for me to understand where levies are spent in a particular region, and so I understand it as someone trying to get my head around the NRM system, how difficult it is to know where money's spent. A lay person paying a levy in the community must find it almost impossible.
David Spears, the opposition spokesperson for the environment, speaking there with Courtney Howe. We're joined now by the Environment Minister Ian Hunter. Good afternoon, Minister.
Good afternoon.
The Liberal Party says that the NRM system is broken. What's your response to that?
Well, they're fundamentally wrong, because their own Liberal government at a national level has scored South Australian NRMs as being the best performing in the country. But look, I mean, David Spears and the Liberals and Stephen Marshall have laboured mightily over many months to come up with a better system, and they've not actually produced very much that's very different, except on 3 fronts. Really, they're taking the environment out of NRM. They're taking it away completely and only going to deal with issues to deal with soil, pest and water. Nothing about the environment's mentioned in their document. They're going to sack local staff. They're actually requiring boards to outsource a lot of the board functions to the private sector, which says to me that, you know, the private sector could have staff from anywhere in the state, and they're not going to employ the locally employed board staff we currently have. And they're going to be duplicating local council functions by having elected board members. I mean, crikey, most of these NRM regions have 10 to 15 councils in their area. And can you imagine the strife that's going to cause? It took me 15 years to get 5 councils to agree on a water management plan for the Keswick and Brown Hill Creek here in Adelaide. I just think they really not produce very much at all.
Much of the frustration about the NRMs being formed, the boards, were that they were centralised in Adelaide.
But that's just wrong. But they're all from local communities. I mean, that's just the wrong statement. If you look at who was on the NRM boards around the state, they are from local communities. So, you know, don't believe everything that gets trotted out by the Liberals. The statements are factually incorrect.
But isn't it about making sure that communities do govern the money that is in their community rather than someone else making decisions? So they're called to have three people out of the seven board ministers on the community. Wouldn't that be better?
Well, that's three less, because what we've actually got is boards made up of local community representatives now. That's who make up the local boards.
But so, where do the levies... Minister Hunter?
The levies go to the boards. They have to set their own budget every year. They go out and consult with their local communities about what they should be spent on and what the priorities should be. They have a very set engagement process. And they go out and advertise in local media and have road shows and talk to local communities and ask them, what do you want this money spent on? And what quantum should it be? So that happens already. All the board members are locally based. They're all regionally based.
You may know that the Liberal Party have run a survey that they say they have surveyed 770 respondents. And they have said that one of the biggest issues that came through that survey was that people did not know where their levies were spent. Isn't that something that perhaps you would be interested in, that feedback, or that your people don't know where their levies are being spent?
Well, there's two points to be said about that. Of course, we want people to know where that money is being spent. But if you ask the same question to people about council expenditure, they'll probably have the same answer. They don't know where their council rates are spent. If you ask them about where their Commonwealth taxes are spent, they probably have the same answer. So, you know, of course, we want people to know where that's being spent. Of course, we want the local authority, whether it's council, whether it's NRM boards, or state or federal government, to be able to explain to the community where their money is being spent. But, you know, a bodgy party survey, I wouldn't put too much faith in that, frankly.
What's your latest consultation with the community been around NRM? Have you done something similar, or what have you gone out to the public to get some information about?
Well, we've done many, many things. I mean, you can have a look at two rounds of consultation that come immediately to mind. One is Kangaroo Island, went out to their local community and said, look, there are a number of pressing environmental programs that need to be addressed here. That will mean we need to raise our NRM rates by this amount of money. Do you agree or disagree? And over many, many months, the Kangaroo Island community incredibly powerfully came out and said, yes, we agree with these important priorities for our diverse communities on Kangaroo Island, and we want you to run these programs. Another one we've just done recently in recent weeks is the River Murray WAP, the Water Allocation Plan, massive amount of community consultation. And the government's come out and announced on the back of that community consultation, we've changed the water allocation plan significantly. We've found an extra 8% of water for irrigators in dry years. And that's all come back from community consultation, listening to the community and changing our policies appropriately. So NRM boards fundamentally must go out and engage with local communities. If they're not doing that, they're not doing their job. But I can give you examples where they're doing it really well. But there's always room to improve. But as I say, the federal Liberal government has rated NRMs right around the country, and they've given 8 South Australian NRM boards almost full marks.
What is your plans for NRM announcements or policy changes at the election?
No, we've already had a range of NRM policy changes about 2 years ago. We took them through Parliament, debated them significantly. We think NRMs are doing a good job, but they need to engage with local communities better, as we all do. And I always talk about community engagement being the key. And one of the great functions of NRM in recent years has been to develop the climate adaptation plans. These were developed from local communities, not from government. Local communities developed them in each NRM region. They were responsible, so landowners, farmers, conservationists, businesses, local government all got together, developed their local regional plan, and then shoved them back up to government. So here you are. This is what we want as a region. Now, you, government, go off and produce our national state adaptation plan, which is what we're doing right now. So we listen to communities, we listen to the regions, we want the NRM to work very closely at the coalface of communities, and we think we're doing that reasonably well. But certainly the federal government believes that.
We do know that, just as an example, a lot of people have become quite frustrated about the wild dog issue because they have tried to speak with local NRMs about that, and they don't feel like they're being listened to as the wild dogs move further down from the mid-north. That's according to Livestock SA. What's your response to people saying that they want to engage over issues like this but can't?
Well, Livestock SA engage with me on these issues all the time. We've appointed a wild dog coordinator out of Port Augusta. Their job is to coordinate the activities of landowners. Federal funding we've put into various programs around the area, but fundamentally control of wild dogs is a responsibility of everybody on the land, everybody working together. And I've met with people all the time about wild dogs, and that's formed our policy, which we've announced only about 6 months ago, I think. So maybe
they don't want that. They want more help from the government.
Well, you know, what the government is saying is everybody needs to work together. You can't have some landowners not having a wild dog policy program for their land because that just hurts their neighbours next door. We need to coordinate a landscape approach to wild dogs. Otherwise, if you don't, if you only work on the land that you have willing landowners working with, then the land next door just lets wild dogs through, and that doesn't work. They can just go around properties and go further south. We need everybody to be in this together. And so that's what our wild dog coordinator in Port Augusta is trying to do, is to bring all the landowners together and say, we are going to do concerted action. The government does baiting programs, but we want you all to be part of that process. We have a landscape effect on wild dog control, not a patchy effect.
Thanks very much for your time, Minister Hunter.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Minister Ian Hunter. He's the Environment Minister for South Australia. I'd love to know what you think about this. We've heard that the Liberal Party says that the NRM system is broken and that they will go to a new body if elected in March called Landscape SA. There's one text, no name. Minister Hunter does not properly consult with the community. We'd love to know what you think about this change. You can text us on, let me just get that text for you. It is 0467 922 783, or you can comment on the South Australian Country Hour page. Would love to hear your thoughts. The other thing I want to hear your thoughts about is the start of harvest. Have you started? Have you rolled the header in? Let me know. I'd love to get a picture of what's happening across the state. You can text that in as well. It is 27 minutes past 12.
Sonia Feldhoff.
Phil on our text line says, I would like to know if the banks would be as profitable if our wages didn't go straight to them from our employers. I would like to know if I can organise my funeral, I am still alive, without going through a funeral home, says Robin.
Weekday afternoons from 2.
Tony says, I cut my finger on a cardboard box. Why are paper cuts so painful and hurt so much? That's true, they really, really are.
And they can take a long time to heal as well.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
The big issues, paper cuts. Just before we head off to the news, first it was grain and now the Aussie almond industry is forecasting a tempered harvest this season. The peak industry body says the nation's imminent harvest is expecting to bring an average crop, a far cry from the records that they were predicting this time 12 months ago. Well, it has been quite the booming industry, the almond industry. Grower and chair of Almond Board of Australia, Neil Bennett, says growers are still looking on the bright side despite the ultimate forecast drop.
Most people seem reasonably happy with their crops. It's not going to be a bumper or huge crop. It's going to be just average. But people are saying the trees are in good health, which that is a good sign to set them up for the years to come.
So when you say not a bumper crop this year, is that just sort of a cyclical nature, or is there other things that are impacting that?
It can be. Mother Nature can have an impact sometimes, but it is cyclical. It can be a bit biennial sometimes. At the end of the day, we're at the mercy of Mother Nature.
So how has the weather impacted what is for the upcoming season?
Well, apart from a bit more rain, we've had to irrigate a bit more. You know, last year was a very wet spring, probably a bit more wetter than usual. This year we've had to supplement that natural rainfall with a lot more irrigation. So, that's probably the major difference.
And does that from what you've just said, therefore make water security so important to almond growers across the country?
Well, I think it's water security for everybody. It's not just almond growers. At the end of the day, we're all trying to grow food for the country and have a reliable supply.
That is Chair of the Almond Board of Australia, Neil Bennett. Despite not hitting the record tonnages as was forecast this time 12 months ago, the Aussie almond industry is undoubtedly still going through a period of rapid growth. So just how does Australia compete in a global market space? CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Ross Skinner, says it's all about selling the quality of Aussie nuts to global consumers.
Well, California is about 80% of world production, but it is one of the great strengths of the Australian industry, having such a big competitor prepared to invest so heavily in developing markets. The Australian industry takes a strategy that we just have to show that the Australian product is the equivalent or slightly better than the US to find a home for it as an alternative to US production.
And do you think in terms of marketing, the industry will look to build on these markets or even branch into new ones?
Well, certainly with the plantings that are going in, our production will increase going into the future. So it is important for us that we do develop greater markets around the world. We currently market to about 46 different countries, the US market to 90. So we will be looking to identify some of these other markets that we could market into, but also develop the established markets that we've already got.
That's Almond Board of Australia's CEO Ross Skinner, ending that story by Tom Nancarrow. The ebbs and flows, hey? It was a booming industry. It still is. It's just coming back to a more average level. Now, I have been asking for your text on the country. You can text in about anything. You can text in about the new Liberal policy, about Ian Hunter's comments that he consults with the community and that the NRM already represent the community, and also about harvest. Normally Melbourne Cup Day tomorrow, I think it used to be kickoff day for harvest. Are you going or not? We have a text from Ben from Gulnare. He says, we had some crops ready to harvest, but the drizzly weather last week has us still finishing off our hay. Make sure you watch those haystacks, Ben. Thanks for texting in. It's time now to get the latest in news. We're joined by Patrick Martin. What's happening in news, Patrick?
Good afternoon, Deb. A gunman has opened fire on worshippers in a small church in southeast Texas, killing 26 people and injuring 20 others in what the state governor says is the largest mass shooting in his state's history. An official has identified the murderer as 26-year-old Devin Keeley, a white San Antonio man who did not appear to be linked to organized terrorist groups. He died soon after fleeing the attack. It is not clear if he shot himself or if the police shot him. The Paradise Papers leak has revealed how rock star Michael Hutchence's lawyer has become the sole owner of the Dead Singer's estate. Four Corners has had access to more than 13 million documents from tax havens around the world through the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists after they were leaked to a German newspaper. And emergency services will work together to investigate and prevent arsonists from starting bushfires this summer. Police today launched Operation Nomad, encouraging the public to report any suspicious behaviour, especially on high fire danger days. Though the state did not have a significant bushfire last season, the CFS says Eyre Peninsula, Mid-North and Flinders Ranges are deemed as high risk this year. More ABC News coming up at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Patrick. And coming up a bit later in the country hour, we hear lots about food waste. Well, a new idea on how to use it.
I had fruit trees in my backyard that gave me an abundance more than I could use, and I was relatively new to the area, and so my immediate network also had an abundance of citrus. You know, when that comes on, it comes on massively. So I ended up finishing the season burying a whole heap of mandarins into the ground, and it just didn't sit right with me that I had this beautiful produce, but I didn't know who to give it to who would actually use it. So it was about connecting to strangers I didn't know, and I didn't have a mechanism to allow me to do that.
I know, I feel your pain. Myself and my neighbour's lemon tree is flourishing at once. You need to have opposition fruit trees, I think, in the street. That's what helps. And coming up that a bit later in the country, but now to get the latest in the weather, we're joined by Brett Gage. What's happening across the state, Brett?
Yeah, we've got a large high pressure system of 1,029 hectopascals centred south of Western Australia, which will move in south of the Bight tomorrow, and then it will move eastwards during Wednesday and Thursday across Bass Strait and then into the Tasman Sea. So we've got a southeasterly airstream today, which is keeping temperatures on the cool side. And basically the winds are about 15 to 20 knots, but we'll get some fresh to strong sea breezes this afternoon. And we've got strong wind warnings for the Spencer Gulf north of Cowra to Wallaroo, and for the lower west coast north of about Coles Point, and for all of the upper west coast, we'll see some strong sea breezes there later this afternoon and in the early evening. And we've got a slight chance of showers about the southern coasts and ranges today. And they'll continue in that area tomorrow. There'll be just a very weak front move up the southern coast tomorrow. And so a slight chance of morning showers about the southern coast and ranges continuing. And getting as far north as about Cleve on the eastern side of Eyre Peninsula as well. Up in the far northwest of the state, there's an upper level disturbance, which will just bring a slight chance of showers to the far northwest corner of the state tomorrow. And then that disturbance will also bring a slight chance of showers to the far west of the state on Wednesday and Thursday. However, on those days, Wednesday and Thursday, as that high will move to the east of the state, we'll be round into a warmer east to northeasterly airstream. So it'll be fine conditions over the remainder of the state, and temperatures climbing during the middle of the week. And then it'll be warm to hot by Friday across pretty much all of the state, and continue that way through the weekend with this predominantly east to northeasterly airstream that will continue through there. And also on the Friday, we've got a slight chance of showers in the far west and a slight chance of afternoon thunderstorms along the Western Australian border inland. Also a slight chance of showers in the far northeast corner on Friday, though conditions will be fine elsewhere. So cumulative rainfall totals up until midnight Friday only going to be up to 1 millimetre in any of the locations I mentioned, getting up to 1 to 5 millimetres in the far northwest corner. Then the longer term outlook for the weekend and for Monday is for a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the far west of the state, but also getting into the northeast pastoral, so anywhere east of about Woomera to Oodnadatta. West of Woomera to Oodnadatta inland, we've got a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms on the weekend, and fine conditions elsewhere, and continuing warm to hot.
How much rain, or is it enough to pull up harvest, or is it just a sprinkling?
I mentioned the cumulative rainfall totals for Friday.
Yeah.
Less than a millimetre.
Oh, okay. So nothing.
Getting to 1 to 5 in the far northwest of the state, and there's no crops up there. So
No. All good. So, all right. Yeah. I missed that. Sorry, Brett.
No worries, Deb. That's all right.
Anything else we need to know across the state?
No, that's it for this week.
All right. Thank you very much. That's Brett Gage from the Weather Bureau. I was listening. I was just focused on all that wind on the weekend. Did you get much of that wind? Gosh, it was sort of like blowing so hard in the morning, and then, as it always does, drops off in the afternoon. Anyway, we've had another text in. Hi, it's Barry from Port Germain. In the last paddock, might finish tonight if all goes well. Yields and quality above expectations. Well, that is great news, Barry. Thanks for that. Over to the far west of New South Wales now for Tuesday, the 7th of November, Melbourne Cup Day. Sunny, winds southerly 20 to 30 kilometres an hour. Overnight temperatures falling to between 11 and 14, with daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 20s. For the lower western, sunny as well. Same winds, 20 to 30 kilometres an hour. Overnight temperatures, though, a bit lower, falling between 7 and 10, with daytime temperatures reaching the low to mid 20s. Here we go. Here's another one. Text coming in. You can text us in to tell us where you're up to with harvest. It's 0467 922 783. G'day, Deb. Harvest is underway here at Kimber. Have finished the canola and the peas. Both about average and of good quality. Been on the wheat for a couple of days now. Above average yield and very good quality. No complaints. David. Thank you, David. That's very good news to hear as well. It's 20 minutes to 1 o'clock.
Sonia Feldhoff.
As a potential grey nomad, I want to know the difference in distance if you travel around Australia anti-clockwise as opposed to clockwise. If you go anti-clockwise, you're on the inside lane. If you go clockwise, you're on the outside lane.
No.
Weekday afternoons from 2.
If you go counterclockwise, you'll do less distance. Works out under 40 metres difference. Is actually more fuel efficient because of winds.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I don't know if he's going to have those kind of answers for us, but we are joined now for our rural news segment by Tom Nancarro. Tom, what's making rural news today?
Hello, Deb. Well, a bit of action in wine today, because I think when we talk about wine exports, I think at the moment it's all focused on China. I think that's the big market at this stage. But South Australia is looking to make a few more inroads into India. Now, they've announced a two-year education program, which is between the state government and the South Australian Wine Industry Association. And I think basically the focus of this program is, which will be in Mumbai and Delhi, will basically educate those over there about what South Australian wine is all about in terms of quality and the different varieties that are there. So, you know, I think it's an interesting idea. I've been reading on the Australian Trade and Investment Commission website that basically the forecast showed that the middle class in India could grow to 550 million by 2025. So there's a fair bit of a scope in the market there, Deb.
It doesn't, pardon me, but it doesn't strike me as the place to go to sell your wine to India. I mean, I don't know culturally. I'm trying to step around this, but I don't know if it's culturally okay to drink wine in India. But I guess the market in China was probably in a similar situation 5 to 10 years ago and thought no one in China would drink wine. And now, of course, their middle class has gone up as well. So it'll be interesting to watch that space.
It will be. And as you say, I think the inroads in China, I don't think anyone really predicted how quickly it would occur.
No.
And I think just on, you know, the sheer weight of numbers and those forecasts that they're predicting, there's bound to be at least some growth that they're trying to tap into.
Great. What else is making news?
Well, there's a bit of action in grain as well. Agribusiness Elders has decided to expand. They've announced today a partial acquisition of a grain trading platform called Clear Grain Exchange. That's a 20% acquisition. Basically, they say that they aim to make it, essentially make it easier to buy and sell grain. So I think one thing you'll notice is that we'll see more changes like this, Deb. I think, as we've all heard, agriculture is a moving beast. I think we've touched on it in this program already. So I think as industry changes as well, I think we'll hear more about this, particularly in the grain space, Deb.
And yes, the ACCC wanting more and more transparency. So organisations wanting to get themselves a part of marketing as well as delivery and all those sorts of things. And what else finally today?
Indeed, Deb. Now, this is a question I'm going to spring on to you. Christmas Day, does your menu entail prawns?
Half the family.
Half the family.
So half the family do the whole prawn, like the cold prawns at the start and stuff. I like cooked prawns, but I don't like the whole seafood platter of cold seafood. So yes, half and half, and the rest of us are all a bit standard.
That's very interesting. Well, basically, I think prawns are a part of Australian Christmas now. So I think every time it sort of gets into this silly season, November, December, people can essentially expect some sort of price rise in seafood and prawns in particular. And just reading in WA that the prices of prawns are expected to jump as you'd expect for Christmas. But this is essentially despite a pretty large season. They've had a, you know, a big season for trawlers out there off WA. And I think, you know, often when you see increased supply of things, there is some movement in price, whether that be downwards in some cases. But Clearly, from what we've been reading so far, is that price is going to continue to rise as the Xmas season approaches, Deb.
Everyone might be going back to standard, like me, if there's no prawns and no oysters or it's too expensive. So, we'll keep you up to date. And cherries also, they've been hit by storms, haven't they?
Of course,
they
have.
It might be a bit more of a standard Christmas fare.
Who knows? We'll wait and see.
We'll keep you up to date. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
That's Tom Nancarrow bringing us the latest in the big issues for rural news today. You can text in about any of those issues. 0467 922 783. I've been asking you how harvest is going. Melbourne Cup has always signalled the start of harvest for me, or in the back of my mind. What's it mean for you? We've had a few texts in. And also, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the NRM debate early on. Liberals are saying they're going to bring in a new style of NRMs, and Minister Hunter says it's fine, don't fix it. That's all coming up. It's 15 minutes to 1 o'clock.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, some of you might be able to relate to this out there. It's normal for young people to put themselves through university with a part-time job in retail or hospitality, or some of you might have worked on the grain harvest. I did a bit of grain sampling in my uni holidays many years ago. But the thriving wool market is encouraging students from the city to learn how to shear. Farmers, agronomists and university students met in Ferner in the southeast last week to take on practical experience and qualifications to become shearers. Sam Furler is studying medical science in Adelaide, and he told Jemima Burt he's learning so he can shear during his university holidays.
G'day, I'm Sam. I'm from Adelaide and I'm learning to shear this week. So,
So are you at uni studying something or working elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm actually at university, Flinders, doing medical science at the moment. What I like about getting into shearing as a profession is that the season lines up well with the uni holidays. So I can do uni throughout the year, and just as summer picks up, I can do a bit of shearing and a bit of cash to pay my way through uni.
So shearing and medicine, they're an unusual combination, aren't they?
Yeah, well, following my grandpa's footsteps, he was a gastroenterologist all his life and retired on a farm, so it's a family thing, I guess.
This is quite an interesting thing, because you obviously have recognised that there's an opportunity in shearing to make some money.
Well, yes. I mean, wool prices are good lately, clearly. People need shearers to sell the wool. Hopefully we'll see a bit of a good period for shearing, at the same time that there's a good period for wool. Apart from that, it's something I like doing. I haven't had good fun over the last week. David's taught me well.
David, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I've been in the game since 79, so, I've seen the highs and the lows. I've seen 180 million sheep, and we're back to 70 million sheep now, but we're getting two shearings a year on some properties, so the work's there. Great for the kids and to come out of the city and have a go at our rural operations, shearing, managing sheep, working with sheep. It's hard to come by unless you actually get in and have a go at it. So these young ones that come here with all different walks of life, you know, from all different backgrounds, just to be in the shed during the week and handle a live animal and get the wool off. And some of those kids now never held a handpiece on Monday, and they're shearing your sheep in 6 and 7 minutes. So it's quite an achievement, and when they shear one, they do jump for joy, that's for sure.
Yeah. So you have obviously had quite a few people here today. Are there many people like Sam that have come from the city that are using shearing as a side job?
Look, it's a lot of farmers' kids are doing the shearing schools. We do get the percentage. You know, it might only be 15 or 20% out of the city that do come out into the country and smell the roses, as they say, and smell the lanolin. And we'd love them to stick, because we need anyone and everyone to come into this industry, because this time of year you can't get shed staff or shearers in every shed, so there's plenty of opportunities.
Yeah, you were saying before how you need to get shearers from New Zealand.
Yeah, well, they've always come across and helped us out over the years. Great, they've got great work ethic, and our Australian kids go over there for work too, so a bit of a cross-pollination, And it's a great opportunity. These young kids now that are in the industry for 5 or 10 years, they actually travel the whole world. In Italy, Falkland Islands, Wales, Ireland, Scotland. I was manager of the world team this year in Invercargill and in New Zealand for the Australian world team. And the 32 countries that bought shearers and wool handlers from around the world are all saying the same thing. They're losing the young people in the industry, and we've got to create it. Do we make it sexy again? I think we've got to get the young ones back in there and experience it.
Making shearing sexy. That's David Brooker ending Jemima Burt's report there. And I'm interested in anyone out there that might be bucking the trend, challenging the rural or farming stereotypes, as Sam, studying medical science in Adelaide and shearing in his school holidays. Hats off to you, Sam. I couldn't even hang on to a hand paste when my dad handed it to me many years ago. Hot. Too hot. And hard to hang on to. It is 10 minutes to 1 o'clock.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And you can text me at any time, 0467 922 783. As Dave has done, he says, the NRM name change don't fix anything. We need to wake up. That's in reference to the Liberals putting out a policy yesterday. They're going to reform the NRM and call it Landscape SA, not Land Care. SA. It's 10 minutes to 1 o'clock. When the ABC shared some photos of tons of tomatoes left rotting in a field because they weren't perfect enough to sell in the supermarkets, there was an outcry from hundreds of people worried about the waste. One woman has set up an online platform to connect communities so they can share, swap, and sell what they have spare on their farms or in their gardens and kitchens with others. Jennifer Nichols went along to a farm at Maroochy River to find out what it's all about.
Here, girls. Here, girls.
Hi, Sharon. I've got some wonderful mango chutney and I'm looking forward to tasting your yummy eggs.
How about we do a swap?
Sounds like a wonderful idea.
At Sharon and Glen Otto's Maroochy River Farm, Helen Andrew has turned up to exchange the spare harvest.
It's to connect people who have spare produce or garden resources in their kitchens, gardens and farms. So it's about making sure all those valuable resources are constantly circulating in our community and don't end up in landfill.
Where did you get the idea from?
I had fruit trees in my backyard that gave me an abundance more than I could use, and I was relatively new to the area, and so my immediate network also had an abundance of citrus. You know, when that comes on, it comes on massively. So I ended up finishing the season burying a whole heap of mandarins into the ground, and it just didn't sit right with me that I had this beautiful produce, but I didn't know who to give it to who would actually use it. So it was about connecting to strangers I didn't know, and I didn't have a mechanism to allow me to do that. So after spending some time researching, I created my own mechanism, and that's when Spare Harvest was born. And you can actually create a share listing, a swap listing, or a sell listing. It's completely your choice.
Sharon and Glenn, what do you actually grow here on your property at Maroochy River?
It's a macadamia nut farm, but we've also got a variety of house fruit trees, I suppose you call them, for ourselves, and there's always excess produce from that and lots of chickens.
We're getting into the bees too, both honeybees and native bees.
How did you find out about Spare Harvest?
I saw it on Facebook and signed up straight away, thinking it was such a great idea, and met Helen through that.
What do you think of the idea, Glenn?
Oh, it's brilliant. You know, like there's so much waste that goes off on farms, play out into the ground. You know, just because a banana is not the right shape or it's got a few marks on it, or likewise with most produce.
Helen, Andrew, we had a recent case where there was a study into tomato waste up at Bundaberg and found some 80% of the crop was never used. Ultimately, is that something you'd like to address?
Yes, definitely. The whole concept of Spare Harvest is actually letting people know what you have available that's excess or left over and connecting with that person who actually can use it. So half the problem, we don't even actually know we have a waste problem because it's not told. Whereas Spare Harvest, the farmer could say, hey, I've got all these extra tomatoes left over, I'm opening the farm up or it's for sale. Let the community know through Spare Harvest, they then can contact the farmer and he's got a new avenue to actually sell those tomatoes. So Sharon and I were talking earlier about
people who are making pickles and passatas, it's too expensive to go to the shop to buy them, whereas they could actually contact the farmer, buy boxes of it, go home, make the passata, and then maybe sell the passata on to someone else.
Logistically, how difficult would that be?
Not logistically difficult at all, because the whole concept of spare harvest is everything happens on a local level. So the people that would be looking for tomatoes would be looking for tomatoes in their local backyard. And the way spare harvest is designed, it allows you to see exactly on the map where that produce or that garden resource is. I wanted to start something that could be continued. I didn't want to have a situation where people go, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. So I invested quite a lot with law firm to actually make sure I got all the conditions and terms and whatnot set out to allow spare harvest to be sustainable and continue on. There's a lot of rules and regulations around sharing and selling of meat, so I've stayed away from that to keep it really simple around fresh produce and garden resources. Preserves and jams and pickles, we're allowed to actually share and swap those.
What about workplace health and safety risks on the farm and liability concerns?
That's managed by the individual. So it's up to the individual to make sure that those things are in place before they actually venture and create listings onto spare harvest. Even when people come to my house and choose their herbs and share pots and plants, there's also an insurance risk. But when you're inviting people into your property, that's covered part of your public liability and your house insurance that you've got and things like that. Members on Spare Harvest also have the opportunity to actually choose other places other than their home or residence or farm to do the swap and the exchange. So it's completely between the members on what that exchange looks like, where it happens and how much it costs.
We've met some lovely people, and especially when they come with kids and they get to feed the chickens and collect the eggs themselves, they get the whole farm experience, because some kids just never get to see that.
Aww. Yes, and I do know of a few communities doing their own version of those. That is, that was a story from Jennifer Nichols there, up at Marucci River. Spare Harvest was the program. And yeah, you can see all that online at our website, abc.net.au/rural.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And I have been asking for your feedback today on the program about Melbourne Cup Day. When does harvest kick off for you? Also the NRM story that we had at the top of the clock, and also hay fires and stereotypes, rural stereotypes, with Sam, who was shearing in his school holidays after doing medicine. And also I just want to point to something else very cute on our Facebook page, and I thank Alicia from down in the southeast for sharing this photo of young Finn, who was 3 months old and first day in the shearing shed. So he's probably breaking the stereotypes too. He's got a fantastic look on his face, and he's on our Country Hour Facebook page. So head to South Australian Country Hour and you can see young Finn smiling with some wool on his head. It is time now to get the markets. We've had a bit of trouble, but we've finally got there in the end with John Traeger with the cattle market.
Good afternoon, Deb. A very mixed quality yarding and 483 head met the usual buying gallery and restockers at Dublin this morning. Light veal steers sold from 280 to 326 cents, with the heavier weight calves selling from 280 to 296 cents, and about 15 to 20 cents a kilo dearer. Light veal heifers traded from $1.46 for station types to a top of $290 for inside cattle, while in the heavier weights, the main prices were $260 to $298. Light yielding steers traded from $242 to $330 cents, with the heavier weights trading from $220 to $312 cents, and somewhat cheaper. Yielding heifers range from $220 to top of $294 cents. Grown steers range from $216 to $290. Grown heifers range from $188 to $280, with light cows selling from $172 to $206 cents, and the heavier weights peaking at $220 cents and backed by about 4 to 5 cents a kilo. Light Bulls, the restockers, also lost ground and sold from 204 to 260 cents, while Heavy Bulls to the trade sold from $1.40 for very light dairy types to a top of 238 cents for the heavier beef bread types. This has been John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thank you very much, John, for battling through that. He had a big computer crash earlier and he managed to get us the cattle markets just in time. So thank you very much for that. And yes, another thing that we have been following on Facebook was the emu damage in crops. I'm still waiting back for a response from NRMs to see what they can do to help people, farmers claiming thousands of dollars of damage from huge mobs of emus sitting in crops and trampling crops. So we are still trying to follow that issue. And if you'd like to get in contact with us about any issues, you can go on our Facebook page. That's the South Australian Country, our Facebook page. That's it for me, Deb O'Callaghan. It's coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.